Thank you very much, Bruce, and it really is good to be here amongst a group of people, I guess, whose future depends on energy. I'm here to bring some good news today, yeah? To talk about the outlook for geothermal energy, and I would hope that by the time I've finished, I've got across the notion that geothermal energy is emerging, I think, as a very material option for this country, an option that is very cost competitive. It's an option that is not waiting on technology breakthroughs, and it's an option that does not bring with it any other undesirable attributes. Yeah. So without further ado, if I can launch into that, it's not my intention today to give you an investment promotion for Geodynamics, but please excuse me if it might sound a bit like that. Yeah. The hot rock concept. We believe that granites have natural fractures in them. Whether they look like this or something else, I guess, remains to be seen. But the granites that we're targeting, the hot granites, we believe have natural fractures in them. And the concept is fairly simple. If I just take you through a few things that have happened in the last couple of years. We began by saying we know that there are some hot granites at a depth of about 3,500 metres, 3.5 kilometres. We know that, or knew that, from the oil and gas drilling that Santos had done previously. We knew that the granites had a temperature at about 235 degrees centigrade at the top, increasing with depth. Those granites are hot because of their natural radioactivity, uranium, thorium, potassium. As that radioactive decay has liberated heat or generated heat, that heat has been trapped in by an insulating layer of sedimentary rocks, clay-rich shales, coal seams and the like. So the combination of the high heat producing granites and the insulating layer has really given us a position where these rocks, where the granites are now very, very hot today. So Habanero 1, that was our first well. That made some very important discoveries. First of all, it found that indeed the granites were naturally fractured with some very significant fractures in them. It proved that. It also found that those fractures were full of water, and we weren't expecting that, and that water was under very high pressure. When we measure the pressure at the surface, it's about 5,000 psi, or if you like, enough to support a column of water 3.5 kilometres high. That's a very, very high overpressure. You put those attributes together, and it's really exciting because it means that if we drill a well that we produce from and run the hot fluid at about 250, 240 degrees centigrade into a heat exchanger, take the heat out of that, and then at cooler water, now at about 93, 94 degrees centigrade, that can then be re-injected. That, if you like, is a completely closed system. Really important. We do not need an external or extra supply of water. The thermal energy that we've extracted in the heat exchanger goes into a working fluid that runs off to drive conventional turbines. Very simple system. The technologies, clearly for the subsurface, they're very similar to the way the oil and gas industry operates. The drilling, reservoir engineering, production engineering. At the surface, all of the power station technologies exist from the conventional geothermal sector. So that's why I say that we're not waiting on a technology breakthrough to make this work. This is a map of what we believe the temperature is across Australia at a depth of 5 kilometres. 5 kilometres because we believe that that's a readily drillable depth. There would be something like 400 wells a year drilled in North America to that sort of depth. Yeah. So that's a reasonable level. We can see a real focus here in the Cooper Basin. There aren't any spots shown in Tasmania at this point because all this data is based on oil and gas drilling, and there's not much oil and gas drilling in Tasmania. But that's an interesting sort of outlook, yeah? The proposition has really gained enormous momentum over the last few years. Today, there would be something around 33 companies pursuing geothermal energy in Australia, and about 7 or 8 or 9 of them are listed. The committed work programs that they have for their tenements is over 800 million. We can see the coincidence of the activity here in the Cooper Basin that matches the heat map that we looked at before. We've also got some broader tenements that have been let in Victoria, and there's a bit of work going on there. There's some interesting stuff that's now going on in Tasmania with Cooth Energy, We know that there are high heat-producing granites there, whether they've got the overlying sediments to insulate them and provide the reservoirs remains to be seen. Allegiance Mining up in the northwest of Tasmania, some of their drilling for nickel has indicated very high temperatures, so we'll wait and see what happens with Tasmania. This is where Geodynamics are focusing, but there's a whole lot of other companies in around there as well. But let me just focus on the Cooper Basin because it really is quite special. Now, Australia got lucky years ago with Broken Hill and Mount Isa and Olympic Dam and the Northwest Shelf. Well, I think we've got a resource, a thermal energy resource in the Cooper Basin that is probably more significant than any of those in energy terms. This is the way temperature increases with depth, increasing to about 235 centigrade, and that's pretty hot, yeah, at a depth of 3,500 metres, and around 290 degrees centigrade we expect at the nominal 5,000 metres. And it keeps on going. Interesting here that there's no effective bottom for the granites. We know that they go for at least another 12 kilometres, so we don't have to worry about bottoming out. Now, those temperatures are really important. In fact, you could argue that temperature, along with well productivity, is the most important economic driver of any geothermal energy project. And if I can just illustrate that, we can see here the way net power output changes as a function of temperature of the fluid that's produced. If we're looking at a base case here of, say, 240 centigrade, that's our base case, if we can get another 20 degrees, 260, we'll get about another 20% more power at no extra cost. It's about another 1% more power at effectively no extra cost per degree centigrade. So temperature absolutely drives things. Interesting that in Germany at the moment, you cannot get a geothermal tenement. They're all taken, and they're excited with 170 degrees. I said that productivity is important. We have to get the flow of hot brine up to the surface at a reasonable flow rate. We know the rocks are jointed. We've said, can we open up those joints a bit to increase their permeability? We know that the Cooper Basin, because of the way Australia is moving northwards and colliding with New Guinea and Indonesia, we know what the stress environment is, and we know that we expected that if we inject a bit of water into those fractures, we could stimulate a little bit of movement, 3 millimetres, 5 millimetres of movement on those joints. And if we could do that, because the joints are rough, that would open up the permeability very nicely. So in Habanero 1, we injected 20,000 tonnes of water. And if we can flick that, Thomas. and as the movement takes place, it emits little microseismic signals, like micro-earthquakes, if you like. And this is what we can see here in plan view. We monitor these so we can understand what's happening as we inject water. So we'd injected water here into the centre at 0, 0. This is a plan view. The different colours are different time stages in the process. So we can see that we've actually got small movements to take place on these joints to stimulate an effective reservoir area over a distance of about 3 kilometres by 2 kilometres. Now, if there's a reservoir engineer here and he saw that, he'd have an orgasm. That is absolutely exciting, yeah? The oil and gas industry can't do that. We've done it not because we're smart, but because it's the geology, it's the stress environment in the Cooper Basin that lends itself to that sort of response. Really exciting. We're looking to produce hot brine from each well at around 100 litres per second, about 144-gallon drum every 2 seconds, at a temperature of over 250 centigrade, and it's got a pressure of about 5,000 psi. Now, there's some engineers here who will just feel that. There is more energy equivalent in that than 10 wind turbines. Let's just talk about materiality for a minute. I said that we're focusing up here in the Cooper Basin, and just a couple of tenements that we've got here, these tenements, I've blown up. And this is what the temperature map in just two of them looks like. And we've delineated quite confidently, that is, we know the depth, we know the aerial dimensions, and we know the temperature. So we've delineated bodies of energy there that equate for about 400,000 petajoules. Now, that might not mean much to you, but when we put when we overlay a power development on that, it would be enough to support around 10,000 megawatts. Now, that's a very significant amount of generating capacity in anybody's terms. That would have the annual output of about 15 snowy schemes. Now, it's a big lump. There are other spots that we're also pursuing, but the Cooper Basin, I think, is the exciting bit, yeah? Let's look at a marketing perspective. We know that greenhouse, emissions trading, renewable energy targets are going to change various competitive positions. The columns I've got shown here, I've all taken from Ziggy's report last year. Now, I know that some people from Pacific Hydro might have a look at the wind numbers and they'd probably crank those up a bit to something closer to the $70 plus level. You can take your own view as to what you think about the cost of nuclear. The other dotted bars I've put in here are the impact that emissions would have if we allow it at, say, $30 a tonne. And I feel quite comfortable that $30 a tonne is a conservative estimate in gross terms with where we'll finish up by being. We're looking at getting power from the Cooper Basin into the national grid at about $55. The assessment that Geodynamics has made, that other people have made, for example, Babcock and Brown Power, some assessments, some more refined assessments that McLennan Magazenic have made, would all suggest that the two really cost-competitive options that are in front of us are gas and geothermal, depending what happens with nuclear. People talk about transmission, and I think everyone at the table over lunch said, but what about transmission? Everyone asks that question, yeah, and it's an important question. But first of all, just let me ask you to stop and think about the infrastructure challenges and the investment in the Pilbara, for example, the fact that we have oil and gas pipelines already from the Cooper Basin to Brisbane, Sydney, Adelaide. The point is that if a resource is large enough and of high enough quality so that the economics stack up, then you will take the infrastructure to it. That's a general comment. More explicitly, we can see various geothermal propositions in here. We know the Olympic Dam is contemplating, the BHP are contemplating an expansion at Olympic Dam. There are a couple of options that we've got in order to ramp up, and that the challenge is more of a ramp-up challenge rather than a long-term challenge. If we can get power to the grid at $55 a megawatt hour, including the cost of transmission to, say, Adelaide, then there is not an economic problem with the transmission. The challenge is how we build it up in increments, how we ramp it up, yeah? Do we look at building a 250 megawatt transmission line on day one, knowing that we can't fill it for a couple of years? How do we cover the costs of that unfilled transmission line? So it's a ramp-up challenge, a staging challenge that we've got. And there are a couple of options. Clearly, there's an option for a reasonable capacity line into Olympic Dam or down to Port Augusta, and the actual distances for those two lines aren't very much different. And you might be looking at something close to $200 million to build those lines. That's not an insurmountable challenge, yeah? Once we know that we've got the confidence in our capacity to fill them. Some people are excited about the proposition of transmission to Adelaide, Western Sydney to Dubbo or to Western Brisbane, partly to get power from the Cooper Basin into those regions, but also to provide a connection between effectively the two ends of the national grid. Some economic work suggests that just being able to connect the two parts of Australia's grid, which is essentially a coastal one, is worth around $400 million just on its own. There are a lot of other options that are being looked at to do with that national grid, and I guess over the next 12 months, the details for how we progress with transmission will sort itself out. Okay, where are we at the moment? So far, we've completed Habaneros 1, 2 and 3, and we call our wells Habanero because Habanero is one of the hottest chilies around. First well down to 4.4 kilometres, second one 4.3. The first one identified some fractures and that's what we stimulated, yeah? Habanero 2 was designed to find the same fracture system it did, but we had to suspend that because of various drilling difficulties that gave us a real hiccup that some of you will be familiar with. We then went ahead and purchased our own rig, spent $32 million on this new rig, and we've recently completed Habanero 3 as Australia's first commercial scale well. That did intersect the fracture zone that we were looking at, and we can see some of the initial production testing from that fracture zone. All of these wells are drilled within that stimulated area with all the spots that I showed you before, so we're testing an area that we've already stimulated. We're quite excited with Habanero 3. We were expecting around 25 litres per second from just the one fracture, and we're well over 30 litres per second so fast, and we haven't really let it fly yet, so we're pretty excited by that. An announcement that was made a couple of days ago said that we're on track to do what we call a circulation test. That will involve producing up through Habanero 3 and re-injecting down Habanero 1. So that, if you like, will be a continuous circulation test that we believe will prove the concept, and that will give us the parameters, the reservoir parameters, to do our initial reservoir modelling. We'll also be building a little pilot station around Habanero 1 and 3, and that will be generating power this year. So if we just step back and think about risks, because a lot of this is to do with risk, yeah? We know we don't have a problem with water. We're in good shape with temperatures. We've shown we can build horizontal reservoirs. I didn't show you the cross-section there, but those reservoirs are essentially horizontal, which is perfect if you want to intersect them with vertical wells. Horizontal reservoirs, we've shown we can do that. We've shown we can stimulate the fractures to an area that was much bigger than we'd expected. We know we've got connection between our different wells. We've already had our initial production from Habanero 2. Concept studies have been completed. The proof of concept work, I've said, we'll have tucked away over the next month or so, and we'll have our first generating plant also tucked away this year. But we're not quite there yet. We do need to drill down to about 5,000 metres. That's an extra 600 metres, and essentially repeat what we've already done. We believe we can do it, but until we've done it, it's got to remain on the table. The surface, there are essentially no technical risks there. We do have the commercial issues, and we've just spoken about the transmission line issues. Our plans for the first generation, 2008, this year, 50 megawatts at the end of 2011, 500 by 2016. In terms of the country, the federal government has set a 20% renewable target by 2020. And we know that the Cooper Basin has got a resource that should be able to support over 10,000 megawatts. Now, if we just put some other numbers around that, that 20% target equates to 45 gigawatt hours, yeah? 45,000 gigawatt hours. Okay, 20% target, 45,000 gigawatt hours. That 10,000 megawatts would equate to around 78,000 gigawatt hours. We won't get all that developed by 2020, clearly, but the point I want to make is that the potential that Australia has to meet some very significant renewable energy targets, clean energy targets, is well and truly there. Thank you very much.